Mr. Duncan, Reel 7.
Yes. And we're back to the Adriatic. The crossing over was at night, and we'd come right across the really mountainous spine of Italy. We lost one gun over the side. That was remarkable at night. They'd come to this bend, and the number one had got out of the vehicle to guide him round. He stood in front, and he held his hands up and to halt, the signal for halt. And he was going to guide him back a bit on the different lock of the wheels. One wheel was precariously hanging over the side. And with air brakes, you do get that split second when they don't operate before they really come on. And the whole lot went. It went over the side. it dropped something like 20, 30 foot and then rolled for about 80 yards down the side of the mountain. Luckily, a tree stopped it. The gun broke away and the driver, he was thrown forward against the wheel and broke all his ribs. Now, up behind, you've got the compartment where the detachment are. They're sat, there's 12 of them sat in two lines of six. It rolled down, as I say, and come to a stop upside down. And the thing that stopped them being crushed, because the vehicle had a soft metal roof, with the ammunition boxes that stopped the chassis coming down on them. But beneath the two seats were the batteries, used batteries. They're upside down. They can't get out because the doors are squashed down and the batteries spilling out on them. We got down over the side in the dark and took us about a couple of hours to bloody get them out with crowbars bashing the wood in, easing the doors out, you know. But remarkable, not one of them killed. The gun was a write-off, of course, and the vehicle, you know.
But that was just in the process of crossing.
Crossing, yes, over to the Adriatic. The position we deployed in was quite a clear valley. You could see across the other side. Down in front of us was a battery of heavy artillery. Behind us was tanks. But we knew the Canadian Div was going to put this attack in on the Gothic line, which for once wasn't a river crossing. It was an actual land line they built. The attack went in. And was quite successful. And we're now talking, I said we support, when we supported these attacks, this one in particular, 400 rounds we fired each gun in the opening barrage. and we moved, the attack was a success, we moved up to Rimini. momentarily, we'd come under, whereas we'd be under the, like the Canadians, we'd come across the Greeks, something like this, a brigade, and we actually come across the Greeks here. there was a Greek pioneer unit where we moved in alongside of us. some of them could speak English or broken English. We got it. They were quite brutal toward the Italians, of course, because we hadn't experienced Italians occupying Britain, but they experienced Italians occupying Greece.
What type of things would they do?
Oh, they definitely, there was one case there, the instruments, the predictor instrument, Vickers predictor, it quite heavy, it weighed about 200 weight, and to lift it, they had porter bars that slid through slots, and four men would then lift it up onto its pedestal, you know. And this Italian elderly chap came following this Greek soldier from this house, come by where the predictor pit was, and the Greek soldier had a radio, a portable radio, which he'd stolen from the Italian house. And the old Italian chap was raving off about him, and he just stopped and slashed him with his bar across the bloody head. And a couple of our blokes jumped out and stopped it, you know. But he could have quite easily have killed the poor old chap. And he blatantly turned round, because we'd learnt quite a bit of pidgin Italian by now. And in between talking to the old Italian, in pidgin Italian, the Greek made it quite clear that he wasn't a bit worried, but they thought, bloody British, you know. He said, you haven't seen these bastards the way they can perform, like they've performed in my own country, you know.
This was near Rimini?
Yeah, near Rimini, yeah. near Rimini, too, we also came, supported no, I'm jumping myself here, because at Rimini, we'd supported the Canadians for the attack through the Gothic line, broke it, and the Canadians took, they went out for a rest, the Canadian division, and for the first time a division took us out to rest with them. We went to a place called Iggy Maria on the Adriatic coast, and we had a fortnight's rest there, and then went back into the line at Rimini, and come up with the Greeks and the New Zealanders again. The advance went quite from there up to the Limone, the River Limone near Faenza, came to a stop there at Faenza. Again, a river crossing, you know. we crossed the Limone. That would be... we spent Christmas there, in the line there, at Faenza, which is on the banks of the Limone.
Were you able to have a proper Christmas there?
The gun site, or gun position, was near a couple of houses, with a farm, with a big barn, and we were able to get in the barn. The cooks did as well. We had a good quartermaster by now, quartermaster sergeant, that is. He, amazingly enough, he was an ex detective for the Metropolitan Police. So instead of a thief to find, you know, he'd gone round and he'd swapped clothing. He'd built up a surplus of old clothing, and went round and swapped this old worn-out boots that he kept. You know, he knew what he was about and got quite a few chicken off the Italians. And we, you know, had a wonderful Christmas fair he'd done for us. the line comes static there because, again, we got snow. It was winter snow on Christmas time. this was interesting, too. We crossed over. We'd gone over the Limone, and the next river is the Senio. and they're only about 8 miles apart. All right. Yeah, about 8 miles apart, I think. And this was at the time when the Yanks got pushed back in the Ardennes in the last German assault against the Yanks in the Ardennes. And so there was a big flap on that he was making an all-round offensive on all fronts. And we got whipped back across the river because they even prepared the bridge for blowing it. We pulled in. BHQ had been in this site just over the river, north of the river, and we pulled in as they pulled out, and it was in a vino brewery, big brewery. Chap and I, my mate, off our gun, we went scrounging, and there would be about a dozen huge vats in this place, all uncovered vats, but one. It was covered over the top. And where the valve was for the outlet was a huge wooden bung had been knocked into it. So I said to him, go and get the sledge off the gun. Sledge off the gun, we knocked this. The bung come down. It was full of vermouth. We're absolutely swamped in vermouth. We got the wooden bung and can't get it back in until we could get some arrangement fixed up for getting this vermouth on tap. And the next thing we knew, a New Zealand truck pulled in. What are you doing there? It's what this vermouth like, you know. And within about an hour, they got this tap, these keywords, got a valve on it, and they could control it. And along the road was about a quarter mile of water trucks running their water off and pulling in and filling up the vermouth. And we got back across the river on this vermouth. We were all sloshed on this vermouth. But we got back across the river, and after about a week, the flap was over, and we went back across for the getting ready for the final push across the Senio. Another thing, we spent the winter there, and then come the spring. Now this would be spring of 45, isn't it? When the war finished, spring of 45. This big push across the Senio now, which everyone thought was going to be the last push. And one of the Indian divs was going to do the assault over the Senio. And the Yanks were, it's amusing now to, for old soldiers like myself, to see this friendly fire, as they call it now. And they killed a few in the Gulf with friendly fire, didn't they, the old Yanks? And for this big push across, I forget which one of the Indian divs was. There was about four of them, I think. The sixth had been disbanded. I think it was the eighth Indian div was going to do the assault. And they had, on each flank where they were going in, they had white markers laid out. They had, on the windward flank, as there was a wind, red smoke. Containers letting the smoke off to denote that that was the riverbank. They had 213 battery, one of our sister batteries from the regiment. They had them back behind putting up a row of bursts, say 17,000 foot in the air above the river, to denote that that was where the river was, so that when the forts came over to drop their bombs, they had to be behind this row of airbursts in the sky before they dropped their bombs. So we could hear them coming, the forts. 213 open fire. No sooner did the burst appear in the skies than the fort turned and dropped the bombs and caught the Indian diff. Instead of going over the river, they went in where they were.
With heavy casualties?
Yeah, heavy casualties, yeah. There was heavy casualties. And, you know, they had this reputation with us anyway. You couldn't trust them. Especially in bombing, you know. Probably unfair, but... So, from then, it seemed from then that it was just a rush, because this is now talking about something like April, this will be about. And we just moved from position to position, sort of half a dozen positions within a matter of 2 or 3 days. And then we'd lost the Bren guns, we hadn't lost them, but in place of the Bren guns, as local defence against aircraft, we'd got 0.5 Brownings machine guns, and they were going back a little bit, sorry. Prior to this, we'd at the Lamoni, we got blacked out. That's the expression we used. We pulled back from the river about 2 miles, went into a farmyard, deployed the guns there, and were paraded, and were told that all the white gunners on the guns, less the sergeant and the bombardier, and the Lance Bombardier, were going back to be trained as infantrymen. And we would get black troops, Bekuanas, in place of them. And we got, you know, actually there, within a couple of days they'd gone, leaving just 3 of us on a gun, and these Bekuanas came in. They'd been trained in anti-aircraft role, and they'd actually... way back in the piece, at Benghazi, actually had engaged a raid, against a German raid in Benghazi. So they'd been in action once in the anti-aircraft role. We'd laid on, the position we were on, the Lamoni, we'd laid there about 6 weeks prior to this, and had not had one... shell fired against us. It was very unusual. We're everywhere. We get, you know, get till we come over. So we went back into exactly the same position with these Bekuanas, who had never fired it in the field role before. But we'd had a week or so with them back in this farmyard. Each gun had a corporal on it, Bekuana corporal, who could speak English. Most of them could speak pidgin English, but the corporal could speak fluent English, so that anything that they were unsure of, he would translate to them in Bekuana. And they'd came the old white man's supremacy with us, given us, I was one of those who didn't go back, by the way, so I stopped there. They gave us a lecture. He was like a colonial administrator, had come up and given us a lecture on how to handle these chaps, how to behave with them. And they'd come the old, as I say, white man supremacy, wherever possible. If you can sleep in a house, you sleep in a house, and they're sleeping bivouacs, you know. And don't be standoffish with them, which obviously was alien to us anyway. We couldn't be like that with blokes on the same bloody gun as you would. You just couldn't be, you know. Even our gun sergeants and bombardiers, it wasn't Sergeant, it was Fred and Tom, Dick and Harry, as long as there was no senior officer a mate, you know, and you would swear at each other, you know, I'll piss off to him, jokingly with your sergeant, you know, in the relationship you get. So, hey, could you be like this? I'm the big white buono. So, back we go in with them in exactly the same position. And a fluke, or his intelligence, German intelligence, was remarkable, because that night, oh, bloody hell opened up on us. And we had been made to get into houses, into these farm houses, because by now you're only down to 12 men on the guns, you see. So 12 of us were made to sleep in this house that happened to be there, and they had to sleep in the tents. but wherever we went, we always dug slit trenches in to jump into in case any shelling did take place. So when this opened up, we thought, well, what are them poor buggers going to be like? You know, down we go, got torches, and they're in the slit, and they are literally terrified. First night coming back into this, and the corporal on our gun, his Christian name was Tony, and he spoke fluent English, and he'd been a Oxford student before the war, Oxford educated. And we shone the torch down in the, and we thought his head had been hit, but it was his hand mangled. He put his hands up like they're in a lump of shell and hit his hand, so we took him over to the command post to get dressed, and we take him in, and the troop commander came in as we came in, you know, and he saw his hand, and he said, what's that? He said he's had his hand hit, so he turned to him, he said, plenty boom boom, mate. The big buana talking to her in an immaculate English. He's turning around, he said, oh, not so bad, he said, as I thought it was going to be, old chap. So I think we were there about a week, and then the big push come off, and it was then, as I say, as I said before, an helter skelter then. And these Bechuanas, within a fortnight, they were knackered. They just couldn't stand the pace of being up all night. And so from that point of view, they were what we thought of the poor old native, you know. Kind of lay under a tree and sleep all day.
Why was there a difference between them? Just because they weren't fit?
They didn't have the stamina. Probably their mental outlook wasn't like ours, you know.
Not as stoical, you mean?
Well, yeah, exactly. And their first night in, it was a terrible experience, I should think, for them. That first night in, you know. Because they'd suffered about 10, none of them killed, but about 10 injured in some way or other, you know. And then, trying to think of the place we'd. Ferrara. We were just outside of Ferrara. We'd dropped into a position. And the same troop commander came, sent for me. And this Browning that I was telling you about, this .5, the chappy in charge of it, White Bombardier, he was a character in the regiment. He'd been in a pre-war in the TA, and he really was a character from Portsmouth. And as I say, quite a contingent of Portsmouth regiment. He couldn't read or write, but he's a lovable character. Lance Bombardier, they made him out of sympathy because he'd had a big family in the TA, you see what I mean? And he carried this Lance straight all the way through the war. And they put him on this Browning with three of these Bechuanas. And the old Swede, the troop commander, sent for me, and he said, you're going to be taxed for a short while. He said, you're going up with Bombardier Rogers with the Browning up onto the River Po. He said, to support the infantry attack across the River Po. So So he said, we all know Brad, and I laughed, you know. He said, so he said, I'm sending you up with him, he said, to keep your eye on him. He said, this again is, I always used to be a victim of this supposedly infantry train that I was supposed to have been in. So anyway, there were three of us. They didn't send the Bekuanas up. Another gunner they sent up with us. And we go up. And as I said about the old flood banks, and the Po seemed to be an even bigger flood bank. And we pull up in a 50 underweight truck we had with this Browning. And we weren't on our own. There was the Browning from the other troop. And the other battery had captured a .75 German flat gun somewhere in the piece. And they had that up there as well, plus one of their Brownings. And there was an officer in charge of us, but he wasn't from our unit, our battery. He was from one of the other batteries. So he explained everything to us. And he said, the attack should be going in about a week. We're going to deploy digging on the flood bank to give them cover and fire across the river. So he said, I've been told to be very careful because we're actually where we're going to deploy is the Jewish Brigade are going to attack across there. And this was a complete Jewish Brigade that they had formed. He said, and the thing we've got to be careful about, he said, is that they... quite a lot of them are German-speaking, he said, and they're carrying out patrols across the river at night, you know. This would be about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. We're up on the bank, come up there, and down below us are all these men dressed up in German uniforms because they were German Jews, and they were doing these infiltration patrols across the river. And everyone's expecting the mother of a battle across the River Po. He'd fired over propaganda shells about when you cross the Po and, you know, you're going to be slaughtered and all this.
So you say they had German uniforms on, but that was breaking the rules of war.
Well, whether it was, yeah, it didn't make any odds. And I think for these German Jews, there was no bloody rules of war anyway, because, as I say, everyone thought it was going to be a slaughter race across there because the river is wider than any of the other rivers that we crossed. It's about half a mile across, isn't it, the Po? And instead of which, it was just a walkover. There was hardly any fighting at all, you know. We fired across the river when they went across in their assault craft and all that. But there was nothing came back where I was anyway, you know. the Kiwis was on our left flank. They went across as well. And it was a walkover for them as well. And then we stopped. Our instructions were now to stop there. And anything coming down in the river... floating down that looked suspicious, to fire at it because they suspected the enemy of putting mines in the river upriver